Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.
All are welcome. We're glad you found us. Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from a glorious day, actually, in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome back to the show Brad Warner to talk about his latest book, Letters to a Dead Friend, about Zen. I don't usually read the about the author section verbatim, but this one in the back of his book is so good, I'm going to just read the whole thing. So I hope that's okay with you, Brad.
That's fine.
Brad Warner was born in Ohio, grew up in Africa, lived in Japan for 11 years, where he got ordained as a Zen monk, now resides in the Hipsterville part of Los Angeles. He began sitting Zazen when he was 18 years old under the instruction of Tim McCarthy and was made a Dharma heir of Gudo Nishijima Roshi in the futuristic year 2000. He used to work for a company that made movies about giant radioactive lizards eating Tokyo, and now he writes books like this one that we're talking about today. He also travels the world showing people how to sit down and shut up, which is great advice for all of us. He has given talks and led Zen meditation retreats in the US, Canada, England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Finland, the Netherlands, Germany, France, Poland, Israel, Belgium, Spain, and Japan, but not Wales, it seems, which is where I grew up. I hope he comes to Wales soon. His books have been translated into fewer languages than those of anyone you've ever seen on the cover of a meditation magazine. But there are editions in Finnish, Polish, German, and Greek, so that's pretty impressive. And supposedly there's one in Hebrew, but he's never seen a copy, or maybe he has, but he doesn't know it because he can't read Hebrew. It goes the other way around, doesn't it, Hebrew? He wishes someone would point it out to him somewhere if the book actually exists. So if you're listening and you've read the Hebrew version of one of Brad's wonderful books, please let us know. He plays bass guitar in the hardcore punk band Zero Defects. That sounds good. And he has had major roles in several movies. I didn't know that, including Zombie Bounty Hunter MT and Shoplifting from American Apparel. He also wrote, produced, and directed his own film, Cleveland Screaming. Plus, he made 5 albums for Midnight Records under the semi-fictional band name Dementia 13. When he's not doing Zazen, Brad can be found at record stores all over the world, searching for obscure psychedelia and songs to add to his incredibly cheesy 70s playlist. He enjoys bad science fiction movies and cats, though dogs are okay too. He's a vegetarian, but tries not to be a total pain in the ass about it. All right, great bio there. That's quite funny, and it really sums up your vibe, doesn't it? You know, sort of a little bit iconoclastic, a little bit hardcore, but with a heart of gold, right?
I guess so. It's you're probably the first person to ever read that. I wrote that thinking, well, the publisher, my editor will ask me to change some things because this is kind of silly. And he never did. So I'm not sure anybody reads the little bio in the back of a book, but
yeah,
but you did. So that's great.
Well, I usually do. I usually sort of, you know, pick out bits, but it was so good in and of itself that it sort of captured something. I hope it was amusing to all the people listening. So the premise of the book is you wrote, this about a dead friend, but then as I read the afterwards, it's mm-hmm. not quite as simple as that, is it?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. There were actually two people who died. They were both friends of mine. They were both kind of part of that punk rock scene that I was part of when I was a teenager in my 20s. And they both died around the same time of very similar causes. They both had cancer. And so one of them I was much more close to when he died than the other. So it is more or less dedicated to one of those people, but I kind of combined them into two. So it's maybe 75% one of my friends and 25% the other, you know, in the end. But so it's not exactly fiction, but it is slightly massaged. I don't know if that's the word, but you know, it's.
Yeah. And I think that's fine, isn't it? Cause you're trying to get to some truths about things, you know. It doesn't have to be extremely literally true, right? There's a greater truth in things. Yeah,
so, I think so. Yeah.
What makes it? You were saying in the book too that you know, when you were writing this book, which was sort of almost like a Zen 101 class, almost, it was a little bit boring. You know, imagining an anonymous person that you were trying to speak to, but when it was focalized into these folks, it became much more interesting for you. And actually, that's the thing. It's probably your most conversational books of all the books I've read. You know, because you really feel like you're having a conversation with Brad Warner when you read the book, and it has that immediacy, I think, that's very attractive too. So, folks, if you want to get a book to find out more about what Buddhism is, or especially Zen Buddhism, but or especially truth, whatever that is, this is a good book in that regard. And it's a page turner because, like I said, it's very conversational, and you feel you're chatting with somebody as you go through the book. The other day, I had a dream. Mm-hmm. And it was two parts to it. One was very nice. I'd just done a talk, and it was well received, and actually it was extemporized, and I thought it was so good. I wish I'd had it, but somebody had recorded it, so I was translating it, whatever you call that, into putting it down on paper. But then the second part of the dream, there was this gigantic snake appeared, and it had rows and rows of teeth. I had my hand, one hand I had on its neck, and the other I had my fist down its throat to stop it biting me. But it was so strong that I had to let go every so often, and it almost got me, and I knew it was poisonous, and I didn't want it to be near me. But then I read the chapter in the book called Wild Beast Jerky, and I thought, that's the same image. You know, it's almost the exact same image. It's the fact that I didn't have to fear this beast, right? In fact, the universe is kind of a wild beast, isn't it? And we can't sort of commodify it. You can't say, oh, I wish it would go away and everything could be nice. You know, I just did a nice talk and I'm going to transcribe it now. You know, because the snake is always there. The beast is always there, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the world is the world, and there's positive and there's negative, and you try to stay on the positive side. I think everybody does, but there's a lot of stuff that all of us have to deal with. That's a really interesting dream too. I don't know. I don't know how that's, you know, the standard interpretation goes, but yeah. So yeah, I do think there's a lot of people want their spirituality kind of neutered, I think, a lot of times, you know, especially in this day and age when everything's commodified and you can pick the one that suits you best, you know, and sometimes what suits us best may not be the most comfortable situation, but I think a lot of people are looking for the, you know, just sort of a comforting sort of faith or something to go to, and that might not be the best. So that's kind of what that chapter was about.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the name Zen is everywhere now, isn't it? You know, the cafe, Zen nail salon, you know, Zen cafe, Zen this, that, and the other. And even ordinary people who would never be interested in Buddhism or whatever, you know, are talking about getting into their Zen and all that. You know, it's become almost like yoga and karma. They've become, you know, Western words now, but we don't necessarily know what they mean, right? They just a general idea that it's some kind of spacey place of calm or whatever.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the pop culture version of Zen. And it's, you know, I suppose it's better that it's out there than it's not out there, but it does lead to a lot of confusion. Like when I first started getting to Zen, it was in the early 80s, and it wasn't as yet quite as commodified. I mean, it was a little bit, you know, there was a little bit of this and that around, but it hadn't, you know, hadn't really exploded into the culture. And I think it's kind of interesting how Buddhism has gone, because at the time that I got into it, culturally, it was probably at its lowest ebb. You know, it had this bit of traction or something in the 60s when people kind of thought it was a cool thing to do. But then, you know, the 60s fell apart and the 70s was the me decade and all the other stuff. And by the early 80s, nobody wanted to know about Zen. So in some ways, I consider that a bit lucky that I got into it at a time when it didn't have all that stuff around it, you know, when and you could kind of count on any Zen teacher you met would be extremely sincere about it, because there was no money to be made in the business. You know, there wasn't anything, there wasn't any sort of appeal in that direction for somebody to just kind of put Zen on something to make a buck out of it. But now it's become, and a lot of people talk about Zen. You mentioned yoga, but at least people are doing yoga. You know, people just kind of talk about Zen and throw the word around. But, you know, we have a Zen center here in Los Angeles, and it's still, we rarely get, you know, we get 10 or 15 people coming to any given meditation event that we put on, which is fine, but it's, you know, it's not as popular as the popularity of the word Zen would suggest.
Right, exactly. Well, it's hard work, I guess, actually, you know, if you really do it in a useful way, right? It's not just something you can take on board lightly, right? The actual practice is tough.
Yeah, it's a simple practice. I mean, you're just sitting still, and I called my second book Sit Down and Shut Up, because that's kind of a description of what Zazen is, but it does require a certain amount of effort, you know, real effort.
Right. So you're pretty harsh on religion in general, aren't you? In the earlier chapters of the book, it's the idea that, you know, we know a lot about things, but it's not really a direct experience. This is the problem with religion, perhaps, is, you know, it sounds nice and all that. And then there's lots of complications maybe that makes it attractive. But, and you talk about that, about Zen too, right? I was talking to somebody last week and they said, the only thing I don't like about Zen is there's all this chanting and robes and incense. What's the real Zen? And I thought, well, that's interesting that would be their view of it, right? Because, and you mentioned the way some of the Zen centers in America have become a little bit more ritualized, right? They've moved away from the original pointing, you know, directly to the heart into more of a structured setting, if you like.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a, the two teachers I had were both really into just sitting, just doing the Zazen practice and getting rid of all the other stuff that goes around with the chanting, the incense, the bells and all that. Although both of them used a little bit of that stuff. I've never seen a Zen teacher who used absolutely none of those sort of props of chanting or bells or incense and things. But there is a kind of a tendency to turn Buddhism turn Buddhism into a religion. I mean, most people would categorize Buddhism as a religion, and I think you can put it in that slot. But there's also a kind of Buddhism that's more about practical practice and very little about religion and very little about holding on to a belief system or following rituals and so on. So it depends on where you go. You know, the big major Zen centers in the US and in Europe that I've been to are real focused on the ritual aspects of it. Although, you know, you always find some of the real deal in there mixed in with it. But I don't know. The ritual and stuff brings people in, I suppose, and it gives them something they can understand and kind of participate in. Whereas the meditation aspects have always, even in Asia, been a little less popular, or a lot less popular. If you're talking about Japan, not that many people meditate in Japan anymore. But a lot of them go to the temples and chant and offer ritual prayers and things.
You know, I'm involved with Hinduism quite a bit, and sometimes I'll go to certain rituals or whatnot, you know, like the Abhishekam, where they ritually bathe the god, you know, the statue of the god, various aspects, you know, with yogurt and oil and honey and you name it, and these endless chants that go on for an hour or so. And sometimes you're in the middle of it, you think, am I nuts? What am I doing? We're looking at this. And then, you know, another sense, if you can shift your mind into it, you realize what's being offered is we're offering up, you know, the best of everything to our own divinity. And when you make that shift, it's like, oh my goodness, this becomes crucially important. You know, I love this idea that I'm honoring this. But if you see it just in its, you know, out of form, you know, it seems just a tiny bit weird. So I think this is the thing with the religion and spirituality, isn't it? They nest in each other, you know, but if you only get the one side of things, it can be deadening. I remember, you know, I've just turned away from my own church upbringing because I thought it was not relevant. Mm-hmm. Now I understand spirituality. I can go back to it and understand a little bit of what they were doing, you know, and it seems more meaningful now. But it's really hard, I think, to communicate. Well, it's impossible, isn't it, to communicate these teachings.
Oh, yeah, it really is. I mean, I suppose they can be communicated, but it's not in the sort of standard way. There's no kind of formula you can give somebody. And, you know, Zen is always talking about being the direct pointing to reality outside of scriptures. And I don't know, there's that formula,
right? Yeah.
To Bodhidharma from a long time ago. But, you know, on the other hand, you gotta. There was a book whose title I thought was brilliant by a Zen teacher named Dainin Katagiri, and the title is "You Have to Say Something," you know, and that's the title of his book, which I think is a brilliant title because you have to say something, and it doesn't really the thing that you say is supposed to be sort of a pointer to something that is beyond the words, but. You know, it's a sort of a common human tendency to get hung up on the words and to argue about the words and to kind of look at it almost in a legalistic way, you know, like it, you know, subclause 85B says blah, 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 you know, and then you kind of rank, think about your spirituality in that way. Or I think that's, there's a tendency to do that, but it really shouldn't be.
Right. That's the old one about, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, right? You know, it's kind of irrelevant, really. But you know, theologians in the Middle Ages really got into that one, and so yeah, more and more about esoteric stuff. And you cut through that. I love the chapters on the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, which you call the Noble Eightfold Path.
I thought that was noble. Such a bad pun.
It was a bad pun, but it's bad it's really good, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, I think what I like about Buddhism and Zen is, you know, at its best, it does cut through the bull, right? There's a story, isn't there, of the bull going through the cow going through the door or whatever, and its head gets through its body and everything, but then its tail gets stuck, right?
Yeah.
And it's one of those koans. And you were musing about this with your teacher, I think, and he wasn't particularly interested in going there with you about it, but
he said
there is no bull, there is no cow or whatever.
Because
we could get caught up in the image, right, rather than what it's really representing. But I think it's a fantastic image, though, isn't it? The idea that we are, you know, the tail is caught up. It sort of sums everything up.
I mean, it is a really interesting image. And yeah, I did have this conversation with my teacher that I relate in the book where I just said, where I gave that to him, and I said, I feel that way. And then he's like, oh, there is no bull. There is no. And he was trying to kind of get me back into a real conversation with him rather than kind of a conversation about old Buddhist literature,
right,
which was helpful. Yeah, but it's an actually it's a really interesting metaphor. You know, the tail gets stuck after everything else is through. It's sort of saying that if you don't completely throw yourself into this, you still get stuck. There's another old Buddhist saying that says, oh gosh, if there's the slightest bit of doubt, the mind is lost in confusion or something like that.
Right.
But then again, you know, sometimes that can be taken the wrong way too, because I kind of fall on the side of doubt is really an important part of any spiritual practice. You should have a bit of rational doubt about anything that you encounter, you know, from a teacher of spirituality. That sort of surrender thing, I think, can sometimes be taken too far. And it's good to have a little bit of doubt. But then, you know, these are, again, you're getting into words, and words always have multiple meanings. So depending on what you're trying to say with your words, you're gonna get stuck sometimes.
Wasn't it Philip Kaplow who wrote the Three Pillars of Zen? Mm-hmm. And he said that, you know, great faith, great doubts, great persistence, you know, were the three pillars. And I've always loved that because, you know, in the Christian West, you know, doubt was supposed to be the worst thing you could ever have, you know, to doubt the existence of God or doubt Jesus was your personal savior or whatever. Whereas, you know, I like the idea in Zen that you could have doubts, you know, because that's a natural part of our skeptical mind, right? And it's a valid part. So, you know, when you marry the two together with persistence, you know, then you make the break through in, or you, there's a possibility of it, right? Because you're allowing, you're not denying, and I think it's important to embrace, right, to allow rather than say some things don't belong here.
Oh yeah, because you don't want to get taken. I mean, there's certainly a lot of scams and things out there, so that's one reason to have doubt. Mm-hmm. But even if you're dealing with a really good teacher and a really good sort of sangha or group, you should still have a bit of doubt, because if you go too far into just complete belief, then belief starts to guide you more than reality. And doubt, I think, kind of is more. I mean, you can doubt another person, you can doubt a system, but you also need to doubt yourself. And I found that's really useful. Like if I just because my mind coughs up some idea and says, well, this is true, then I have to kind of go, well, I don't know. I don't know if my own ideas are really that great. So, you know, I have to kind of find a balance there as well.
Also, you fall into the framework, right, or the buzzwords of that particular path. So so then everybody's talking the same buzzwords and the same framework. So it seems normal, right, until you step outside it and nobody else is using that particular frame of reference. So it's always salutary, I think, to step outside of it every so often and move beyond the buzzwords and the special terminology that we might have, because, you know, it can limit us. It's almost like it forces the brain to move down the same pathways, right, rather than exploring the boundless nature of the mind. So, you know, it could be a problem in that regard.
Yeah, I think so. I sometimes see that happen in large Zen centers where everybody falls into a certain way of speaking, and then they have their special words and all of that. And I've really tried to resist that, because I think if you can't communicate to sort of ordinary people who are not part of your, you know, your sect or your religion, then I don't know where you're going to go with that. It gets tricky. You end up sounding like a cult member or something, which I don't think does anybody any good.
We have a phrase in Britain, clubbable. You know, some people are clubbable and others aren't. And I think what's meant by that is, you know, are you the sort of person that would join a club, you know?
Yeah.
And Zen centers or Christian churches, you know, tend to be clubs in a way, don't they? And there's a danger of being, you know, clubbed. I think, because then you see everything in terms of the club. All right, a couple of things before we break. The other day I was looking at my 7-month-old grand daughter, my youngest granddaughter, and we were talking with someone else, and they said at this stage they have no frame of reference as to their own self. You know, they're still in the universal system before they become aware of themselves as someone. And I thought, my goodness, you know, this is so true. Where we're trying to get back to as adults is to be beyond the self in a way, beyond that separate sense of, you know, I'm separate from another person or whatever. And you have a whole series of chapters on it. But I love the idea you talk about being the center of a universe with no center. We're all centers, right? But we have no distinct self, right? There's no distinct ego or whatever. I mean, we have constructs that seem like us, but that's not the reality of who we are.
It's a real interesting point, because I was just reading a book yesterday about there's a word in Buddhism, anatta or anatman, which is often translated as no self. But the author was pointing out that this probably meant more something more like not self. So whatever you encounter that seems to be a self, it's not self. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, you know.
Right.
It doesn't mean you don't have any personal agency or distinct personality from other people, but to mistake that for a kind of a permanent abiding something, that's the problem that we're kind of working on.
And we fear it, don't we? Because we become so, you know, attached to our own selves. You know, that's the great fear of death, is that I'm not going to be me anymore, right? But as you do a little bit more of this practice, you know, you realize that you as ultimate freedom, you as boundlessness, is much, you know, more wonderful than you as, you know, whoever we might be identifying with. So, you know, it seems like it's a good bargain to swap that out, you know. At least it seems so to me right now.
Yeah, my first teacher had a saying. He'd said it's more you than you could ever be, referring to that.
Yeah, I like that.
And I like that too,
All right, we're at the break. I'm with Brad Warner. We're talking about his new book. It's called Letters to a Dead Friend, about Zen. There's so much in this book, we'll never cover it all, but what we're covering is quite fascinating. Join us for some more after these messages from Unity.
Thanks for joining us. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Brad Warner talking about his latest book, Letters to a Dead Friend, about Zen. And remember, this show and all the shows on Unity Online Radio are now available not just on this platform, but on Apple, Spotify, a whole range of other things. So it's easy to get hold of us. And if you like it, let us know. This is the voice of an awakening world. And today we're talking about Zen. And like I said, this book about a number of letters to a dead friend, it's a sort of a primer, or primer, I think, as they say in America, a primer of Zen. Don't you say primer?
I don't know, actually. I always read the word as primer. But then, like you mentioned in my bio, I grew up partly in East Africa, where everybody speaks British English, so
that's true. Yeah, there we go.
Well,
primer, whatever it is, you know what I'm talking about, folks. One of the my favorite chapters in the book, and there's many, is the one on koans, which is sort of a uniquely Zen thing, isn't it? This idea of some, you know, inscrutable, the nonsensical, illogical, the set of circumstances that forces us out of our usual mind, our discursive mind, right, conceptual mind, into something more direct, right? I think that's the aim of it, is to get a direct experience of truth, right, rather than trying to have it secondhand through discussing it or philosophizing about it. And you choose, and that's a question I had, you've chosen many koans. Are these your personal favorites?
Yeah, they're just ones that have stuck with me over the years. And you know, there's two sort of major streams within Zen, and there's one, the Rinzai, in which they use the koans in a very sort of specific way that a lot of people have heard of, where they use them as kind of questions that one must answer to one's teacher. And what I practice was Soto style Zen, which they don't, at least generally, do that. They use the koans more as sort of teaching stories or examples, and a teacher will give a talk about a koan or something like that. But those are the ones, you know, I had two Soto Zen teachers, and they both sort of would bring these koans up from time to time. And the ones that are in the book were the ones that have really stuck in my memory or have been useful to me in some specific way.
Do we want to discuss one?
Sure, one? Although I don't have a copy of the book in front of me, so I don't know. Do you have?
Okay. I like the finger, you know, that's raised up. The master lifts up a finger. That's his way of teaching. And one of his attendants gets in the habit of also raising a finger. And the master finds out about this and chops his finger off. And then, you know, later the student looks at the teacher again, and he raises his finger to the student. And he's, of course, immediately enlightened, as they always are in these koans. But I've always stuck with me, that one, because it's so true, isn't it? There's the authentic, right? We can't imitate. You have to come to this truth authentically yourself, right? It can't be using somebody else's insights.
Yeah, and I think so. And I think the story is a good metaphor. And I feel like a little weird to have to point this out, but a lot of people will take these things literally. And as I said in the book, I don't think anybody ever really got his finger cut off. I think they made the story that way so that, you know, it would be a hook that you would remember, you know, so that, because you'd have this image of somebody's finger getting cut off. But yeah, it's about imitation. You can't just parrot back what your teacher says. I mean, you can if you want, but that's not the authentic teaching. But a lot of people sort of fall into that idea that if they just repeat what's been said before, then they really understand it. And what we're working on with the Zen stream is trying to really understand this for ourselves. And we use the examples and the words of teachers as a way to aim in the proper direction, but the only one who's going to be able to do the work or come to the understanding is the individual who's doing that work.
Right, and there's sort of levels and levels of understanding, right? We may understand the concept of, say, forgiveness, and, you know, even think we know what it means until we come up against somebody that we can't forgive. And then we realize we know nothing about forgiveness.
Oh, that's a difficult one, yeah.
Yeah, because it's there's an intellectual understanding of what it entails, and maybe even a comfortability with it, that's one of the things that we hold firm to, you know, to be a forgiving person. But then when it, you know, the state happens where we just hate this person and can't forgive, then we're forced to take it to a whole different level, right? It becomes very visceral at that point, rather than conceptual. And you know, that's the finger, right? That greets us, you know, in that regard. So what I love about koans, you can take them at all kinds of levels, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, sure. I mean, there's so many levels, and the stories themselves, you know, they make for good conversation fodder because they always sound so weird, you know, and they're unlike anything that Western religious literature has produced. They just seem some of them just seem bizarre. And I mentioned in the book, a lot of them sound like episodes of the Three Stooges, you know, with people getting slapped or getting their noses twisted. But even that is like kind of trying to get people out of a conceptual thing. If somebody's being too conceptual and too up in their heads, one of the things Zen teachers have traditionally done is to do something physical, like twisting their nose or slapping them or something. And it seems kind of violent. And I certainly don't do that with the people I work with, although sometimes I feel like
doing it. Carrying a big stick around.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the same with another Zen master, you know, Jesus. Because I think actually, if you get rid of a lot of the theology and get to the core of Jesus's teaching, he was a Zen master. And, you know, he talked in the same kind of hyperbolic way, you know, about, you know, it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle and a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. You know, I wasn't talking literally about a camel, though there are books that I've read that did try and posit that, oh, there was a place in Jerusalem that was called the eye of a needle and camels couldn't get through or something, something silly really? Like that. But, you know, but he often talked about, you know, if your left hand offends, you cut it off. I mean, I don't think he meant literally, but he was pointing to a deeper truth, right? He was using metaphor. And unfortunately, we tend to take things a little bit more literally.
Yeah.
Some people don't like emptiness, do they? This the idea of, oh my goodness, everything's empty. I remember being in seminary and we were talking about the darkness. You know, there's an aspect of Christian theology and the divine dark and all the nothing, and everybody in the class wanted to call it no thing. You know, they didn't want to call it nothing. It is something. It's just no thing. It's not a physical thing. I said, no, it's not. It's nothing. It's not just no thing, people. You know, because if you say it's no thing, you're still in some kind of conceptualized understanding. You know, well, it may not be a thing that we understand, but it's still something. You know, and I think that's a trap. You know, I always wanted to say no. It's nothing. It's completely empty.
It's real interesting because that Christian concept of darkness really sounds kind of Zen. And I'm a big fan of some of the early Christian mystics like St. John of the Cross and people like that.
Who wrote about
something I think the Zen teachers, they are actually, I was once comparing something, it was one of the Christian mystics, medieval Christian mystics, and he said something that really sounded Zen. And he predates Dogen and a lot of the sort of famous Zen teachers in some of these concepts.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting.
It could be Meister Eckhart, because a lot of people have, you know, made correspondences there between Buddhism and his teaching. And in fact, he got excommunicated by the church, I think, because his teachings were too, you know, heterodox. They were not acceptable. And but his stuff, I love his stuff, because it's very like you said, it's almost complete. It was one of his writings on detachment, which sounds as if it could be written by, you know, Dogen or somebody like that. It's very fascinating.
It's real interesting. I think sometimes I would say Zen is probably you could call it the mystical tradition within Buddhism, and the mystical traditions within various religions often have more in common with each other. Like the mystical tradition in Buddhism has more in common with the mystical tradition in Christianity than Zen Buddhism has in common with, say, Tibetan Buddhism and things like that. So it's quite interesting how they overlap at some point, or they converge. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Yeah, because if you study, you know, in Mahamudra or Dogchen or whatever, each of the more mystical aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, then it starts to sound quite like Zen, right?
Well, that's true too.
I'm a full believer in that. That, you know, that if you dig enough down beneath the surface of things, you get to the same load of truth. You know, the mother load, if you like.
Yeah. And I think that's really encouraging, because it to me, it sort of is evidence that what we're working on is something that is beyond our religions. And I would like to think that Zen is, at its core, is working on something that is past Zen. Zen is just sort of a framework to put it in. But there's an understanding that it's like science. You know, there are scientific theories, but scientific theories are supposed to describe the real world. And when they don't describe the real world accurately, we should throw them out. And I think that's kind of the way we should approach with religious matters too, you know, but we shouldn't let it become dogma. Because if it's dogma, it becomes an impediment to seeing the truth that it's supposed to be pointing out.
Right. So are you a white Buddhist?
Yeah, I guess I am, you know. But I think you're referring to that chapter where I was talking about the whole idea of Buddhism being a matter of cultural appropriation.
Right, exactly.
A lot of people are pointing out. But I think Buddhism is intended to be a religion, or, you know, religion is kind of a bad word with some people, but it's intended to be something that can be practiced outside of the culture that gave birth to it, or you could even say maybe the culture where it was first discovered. So this idea, and I've encountered it some on the internet, where people are kind of criticizing white Buddhists or American Buddhists or Western Buddhists as being inauthentic or trying to steal from another culture. But Buddhism has moved through a lot of cultures. So you can't even say, if you're going to apply that sort of logic to it, you can't even say Japanese Buddhism is that's a cultural appropriation from China, and Chinese Buddhism is a cultural appropriation from India, and, you know, and even Indian Buddhism, I mean, India is a huge place, you know, where did it actually start from? But I think all of that's irrelevant. What we're trying to get at is a real deeper human truth.
Right. And it's part and parcel of our, you know, obsession right now with, you know, being inclusive and allowing for differences. I think, you know, the idea that, you know, native peoples, first peoples, need to have their own culture and not be appropriated by anybody else, etc. But it flies in the face of reality, because I just read a book called The Silk Roads, which is a history of the various Silk Roads that existed, not just through Asia, but, you know, throughout the world. And, you know, Buddhism was heavily influential in Persia and Afghanistan, even Eastern Europe, and, you know, in those ages. And there was no idea that, well, that doesn't belong here. You know, we're into something else. It's the idea that there was a rich flourishing. In fact, you know, some early Buddhist sculpture was influenced by Greek sculpture, right? And things like that. So I have no problem with it myself. And again, if you go to Japan, you see, you know, the middle of the 19th century, when they were forced to westernize, you know, they took it on with, you know, gangbusters, right? And went from a sort of a medieval culture to a world conquering power in less than 60 years, which is quite phenomenal. So, you know, that's the interesting thing about Japan. It seems very Western in some way, and yet very foreign in another, right? If you go there, some things seem so familiar, and other things seem very, very different, you know, very, very, it's, and they sort of nest in each other.
Yeah, I lived in Japan for 11 years, and it was an interesting experience. I remember when I first got there, in the novel version of 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, which is what the movie, well, they were written apparently at the same time, so it's not really a movie based on a novel. But anyway, in the novel version, there's a scene where this guy is in a replica built by aliens of his home. And whenever he opens a box, like a box of cereal or something, or a box of, you know, whatever, there's stuff in there that he can eat, but it's not cereal. It's, you know, because the aliens only knew what the outside looked like. And I thought, I remember when I first got to Japan, after a few months there, I thought, oh my God, this is exactly like that scene in 2001.
Yeah.
Everything looks Western, but when you open it up and you open up the package, it's not.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, excellent. So, crazy wisdom. Some of us are familiar with that, you know, from various people that, you know, you talk a lot about Chogyam and Trungpa, and there's others, right, who have, and there's Western versions of the same too, you know, talk about Jim Jones but this idea that, you know, it's okay to be a little crazy because they understand things at a level we don't, and so they act out of the box and all that. But that's not always the case, right? They can still be aberrational, right, even if they're enlightened.
It's a real tricky thing, because on the one hand, I totally agree with that, and I'm probably a good example of a person who does a religious practice and doesn't seem like the sort of standard stereotypical religious person. But on the other hand, you do have to be careful with that. And Trungpa's especially an interesting case, because I haven't read any of his books for years, but I remember reading his Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, which is one of his most popular books, and thinking, this is really good stuff. But then the way he lived his life. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with him, but he basically, it's controversial to say he drank himself to death when he was 48, but he died when he was 48 and he was a heavy drinker and it was liver problems that killed him. So, you know, there you go. But I know his followers really bristle if you put it that way. You know, he had some issues for sure, but he was also really, really brilliant in other areas. So it's quite, people are very complicated, I think.
Yeah, and he slept with a lot of his students, sure, and whatnot, yeah, you know, according to many sources. And I know personally of people who've had what they call transmission from him. anyway, one of my favorite Buddhist teachers, Pema Chodron, you know, is a direct lineage of Chogyam Trungpa, right? And she loves him still and acknowledges his, you know, some of his behaviors, but also acknowledges the fact he was, you know, a spiritual genius in some regards. And the fact that the entities he's created, you know, have not imploded, they've continued to thrive and they seem to be offering, you know, good things. So he's an interesting conundrum. You know, there's others that sort of crash and burn, right? That don't have a legacy like he was able to create, but it's still problematic. Yeah.
It's like that finger, the Gute's finger koan that you brought up before. You know, if you followed Trungpa by imitating his behavior, well, you're not going to go, you know, that's going to be a disaster. Mm-hmm. But then look at somebody like Pema Chodron, and she obviously didn't. She kind of got what Trungpa was about in a whole different way that had nothing to do, you know, with the alcohol and the sex and all of that. I don't know. I've always thought, well, it's probably better to just not, you know, get that crazy, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, Trungpa, I've read, had his own ideas about what was going to be best to bring this teaching to the West. And part of what he did was based on that idea. And I don't know, maybe it was in some ways successful, because it did draw attention to what he was doing, and some people ended up understanding the deeper stuff and getting something out of it. So, you know, what can I say?
Yeah. I don't think I'd wanted to have been around, you know, when there were armed guards and and crazy machinations like that. And he was acting like an emperor or whatever. You know, that doesn't seem too cool to me. But I'm not clubbable, so I wouldn't have joined the club, I guess. You end the book with your own translation of Dogen's teaching, which you call the whole shebang, right? Yeah. And it's a great a great chapter, because, you know, it's I love Dogen anyway, but he seems to sum up it in such a, can you sum it up yourself just briefly for our listeners? Yeah, I know that's a hard one.
Yeah, it's a hard one, because I always have trouble remembering my own writing, but it's one of my favorite chapters in Dogen's, and I'm struggling to think of the more standard title of the piece, but it is about It kind of, to me, goes along with that idea of the center of the universe, the center of a universe with no center. So Dogen is talking about this what I call the whole shebang, which is like everything. But he's also talking about our personal relationship and how we are actually part of that everything. And I just thought it was nice to offer some, you know, actual piece of Dogen in that, in the context of that writing that I was doing, all those letters and things.
Right. Absolutely. You know, there's a quote here, this life is the whole shebang and death is the whole shebang. It's the idea that I think undivided activity is where they sometimes,
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
entitled the essay by Dogen. I always say Dogen, but I should say Dogen.
Well, a lot of people do. It's one of these, when Japanese is transliterated into English, each letter, each Roman letter is supposed to stand for one sound. But we have that tendency in English, if we see a G followed by an E, then it changes the sound of it. So it's a natural, you know, thing to do when you know it's spelled out.
Right. I think the essence of it for me is the idea that you know, everything is everything, if that makes sense. You know, that just raising my arm, I think you used that analogy, is infinity right there. It's beauty, it's joy, it's whatever. It's the simplest little things, even if they're apparently the most mundane, you know, it's just as valuable as, you know, a full peak experience or whatever, enlightenment experience. And in fact, we're foolish to even want those experiences when we've got all this already, you know. Like the proverbial fish, you know, in the water, you know, looking for water. I love that idea. You know, just relax into that, right? That every moment is full of wonder.
It's true, and that's, I think, one of our big problems is we miss out on what's right in front of us because we're kind of seeking some other experience. But that's one of the things Dogen points out in that essay is raising your arm is the action of the entire universe. And really, you can even understand that logically, because it took the existence of the entire universe just to make any of us able to do a simple thing like me sitting here talking to you. You know,
right.
The whole universe has to exist in order for that to happen, and it sort of implies that there's a big and very deep connection there that we may be missing most of the time.
Right, and this is not idealism. This is reality, right? And I like that idea too. This is not philosophizing about it. It's just the way things are. It marries science and spirituality too, right? Because the calculus needed to raise your arm, you know, you could write a book about all the various formulas that went into that, but it's the same thing. It's one. So is Marky Moon happy now?
I hope so. You know, I don't know what happens to us after we die. I tend to assume that death isn't exactly what we imagine it to be.
Right.
But I don't like to speculate too much further, you know, than that. So I feel like none of us ever departs from the universe as a whole. You know, the universe sort of needs to have all of these aspects, and each individual person is just one aspect of that. And so I'd like to think that he's out there somewhere. And when I was writing the book, I actually did really try to keep it to, this is exactly how I would write to him if I believed that he could read it.
Right.
So, you know, I tried to, of course, when you're writing a book, you have to do a little bit to make sure the reader can follow what you're saying. Whereas, you know, if you're writing to a friend, it's a little different. But other than that, I tried to be really honest and about that aspect of the book.
Well, I think you succeeded. It's a wonderful book, folks. One of the best books I'd like to have written it. I've read in a while, so I encourage you to get hold of it. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we can say our goodbyes to Brad. Next week, New Thought musicians Daniel Namord and Richard McDishi join me to talk about the 15th annual Empower Music Festival. It's happening at Unity Village in April 29th through May 3rd next year. You can already sign up for it if you'd like to come. It's going to be fantastic. Several scores of musicians are coming. And they also talked to me about the power of music as a force for good in the world. I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of the show. I had to pre-record it, so I know about it already. So join me next week when that airs. Right now, I want to give a hearty thanks to Brad Warner for being on the show yet again. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
And this book, like I said, is available in all the usual outlets. If people wanted to find out more about you, what's your website, Brad?
It's hardcorezen.info. So Hardcore Zen is the name of my first book, and .info because we couldn't get .com. So if you go to hardcorezen.info, there's all sorts of links. There's a blog there. There's links to my YouTube channel. You can buy the book directly from me if you want it signed or something.
But
you can get it at bookstores and all the online outlets as well.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening. This is Unity Online Radio. the voice of an awakening world.
Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.